Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. In what has been, I think it's fair to say, and this might be a gross understatement, a pretty busy week in the tennis world. We're recording on Sunday evening UK time. There have been four finals today and two semi-finals due to rain in Barcelona. Obviously, all four of those finals happened at the same time because tennis be tennising. We've done our best to watch them all, and we'll be bringing you up to date with our thoughts and feelings about all of those results in due course. David's here. He's got a wee hint of a tan, David.
Yeah, I got sunburnt on day one, and this is the result 10 days later.
It's good to know that some things never change. There's something quite comforting about that. Matt, you and I are the same colour we were the last time we recorded a tennis podcast.
Yes, and I'm actually going to somewhere which is a whole 10 degrees colder than where I currently am tomorrow, and calling it a holiday. So who knows what colour I'll be next week.
What is this magical destination, Matt?
It is Northumberland.
Oh, well-known holiday destination, Northumberland.
Yes, playing golf next week. Looking forward to it, but it is going to be chilly.
I'm delighted to say that Pam Shriver is here, folks. Pam, have you ever been to Northumberland?
I may have, but I don't remember. But I have been to places 10 degrees colder. But tomorrow I'm actually going on a four-night, five-day retreat to just north of San Francisco. So quite a few of us are departing on trips.
I think,
Matt,
you win.
You've been out holidayed. Pam, we're really chuffed to have you with us. This has been a meaty old week for tennis, and that's before we get into those four finals that all happened at the same time earlier on today. A lot of issues to cover here. We're going to start with, first and foremost, an issue that you have raised and drawn attention to so impressively and so bravely on this podcast, and that the tennis world has been responding to over the course of the last few days. Steve Simon responded to it on this podcast. I interviewed him a couple of days ago. If you haven't listened to that show, I do recommend you have a listen, because he covers pretty much all of the big topics and is pretty clear about where the WTA stands on those topics. Pam, what have the last few days been like for you?
Well, it's certainly really different than any other 4 days for me. It's just been, it's actually been very rewarding, the support I received. I think, first off, hello, Billie Jean. I got some really nice messages from the original Billie Jean. It sounded a little more understandable. Okay. My dog's going to start barking too. I've been really felt quite supported by my peers that I played the tour with. I felt supported by the WTA tour, my friends, my family, both from decades ago in Baltimore to my current friends where I've been living in here in LA for the last 20, 25 years. I've heard from some people that I hadn't heard from in literally 35, 40 years. And no regrets. Like, I just feel it was the right time. But I will tell you that my education into the whole subject of sexual abuse, coach athletes crossing boundaries, my education really just began with my podcast that we recorded at Indian Wells now, what, 6-7 weeks ago.
Pam, has anything about the reactions and the responses that you've had, has anything surprised you? I don't know how set you were in your mind about what to expect after the release of that show, but has anything surprised you?
Well, I kind of learned in my 14 years of a 12-step program to not have tons of expectations, just kind of take it one moment at a time. First off, it was a really interesting morning. For me, it was bright and early. It was like 5 a.m. when we were, we'd already moved our timetable ahead by a day because we knew that Wimbledon was going to have a big announcement regarding Russian and Belarus players. So we thought we'd get ahead of that. And then, you know, when I woke up and saw that there might be another delay, and I'm like, no, I didn't sleep well. It's time to release the pod that had been recorded in Indian Wells back in March. No real huge surprises. One or two players who I played at the same time, I thought it was interesting. They put tweets of support open for anyone to read, just about, you know, one from Leslie Allen, for an example, who said, along the lines, I'm paraphrasing it, you know, we all knew that she didn't use train wreck of a relationship, but just sort of saying they all stood by in denial and nobody did anything. And I just thought that was sort of her way of not really necessarily apologizing, but just saying things were very different back in that time. And what I've been really, really positively impacted by is how many parents and how many people of children who enjoy sports, children, teenagers, even young adults who have said thank you, that they think that this kind of conversation needs to come out. The storytelling and the precision of the storytelling, as I remembered every step, is really important to understand how it can be. And then in today's world, how we can create safer work environments for our young people, and in this case, young tennis players.
In terms of the next steps, Pam, which I know is one of the main, if not the main focus for you, you know, changed, but bringing something positive from all of this. What did you make of what you heard from Steve Simon in his interview here a couple of days ago?
Well, I think just like when I called Steve Simon privately to give him an advance notice of my story, he offered me at the time privately his immediate support and anything the tour could do to help me. But also, he knows, he's aware that it's still a problem today. And I think that maybe my story has begun to shake things up a little bit harder, and maybe things will speed up as far as getting some experts in who can really put down better workplace protocols. Because let's face it, what we're dealing with here, when we talk about a coach player, it's the same really relationship as like a student teacher. And it's a position of power. And so what I've learned, even since I recorded the podcast with you, Catherine, and I related mostly to the emotional abuse through the years of the relationship and after, really, is I recognize now, with the help of some experts in the field, it wasn't just emotional abuse. First and foremost, it was sexual abuse, based on the fact that he was my coach. We entered into a coaching pupil partnership where he was to help me become a better tennis player. And it was through that access that the relationship flipped into something more. And as it works out into 2022 today, more and more workplaces look at that kind of crossing over of boundaries as sexual abuse. So I really feel that coaches and team members, eventually they need to be shaken up the most and be trained on how not to cross over, because just like teacher-student relationship, the teachers, the coaches, as I said during the podcast, they are the adults in the room.
That was something, Pam, that Steve alluded to in his conversation with Catherine, is that The WTA do early on next year intend to revamp this accreditation, this credentialing system for people coming into the sport, for people that are going to be team members, coaches, players, bringing people with them. And he made it pretty clear that this is something new that doesn't happen right now or hasn't to date. What do you know of what will happen? What do you think needs to happen in that regard? What sort of training should they be having?
Well, first off, I don't know a lot of what is currently happening or being developed, but I do know of some developments in other sports, and I have some friends from other sports, and I'll just mention one, Nancy Hogshead, who was an Olympic gold medal swimmer in the 80s. We're the exact, virtually the same age. We have three kids, including twins. We've stayed in touch through the years. She got her law degree after completing her competitive swim career, where she was abused as a collegiate swimmer by her coach. And she's made it really her life's work to advocate for safer workplaces for young athletes. And she's been brought in by many sports, but she has helped really many ways revolutionized the workplace in elite swimming. And I think that experts like Nancy, it may not even need to be a big panel like the age eligibility panel. It may literally just need to be a team of like one or two people who've done this before in other sports. But the tennis world has to be open to this. The tournaments, and they offer the physical workspace plus their hotels. And we know from the situation with Zverev and the abuse allegations there that the tournament hotel is also seen as a part of the tournament site. And so I just think they can't reinvent. They don't need to reinvent the wheel here. I think the wheel actually has been reinvented in a couple of sports. So I'm still early days. Nancy Hogshead had said to me on a phone conversation a couple of days ago, Pammy, I'm going to make you an expert in this field. And I was like, okay, if I'm going to step up and tell my story, that's one of the things I should be willing is to become more of an expert. And I'm not there yet.
Pam, one of the elements to Catherine's conversation with Steve was what sort of possibility is there, facility is there for players, for coaches, for anybody who's concerned about something that they see on tour to report it, to let somebody know in authority that something doesn't look right to them. Those were words you used. That doesn't look right to me. And I personally didn't feel like I got a satisfactory enough answer, a clear enough answer to exactly what that meant from Steve as to what was in place. Now, maybe that's because we're outsiders and all players and all coaches know what should happen in these situations. Well, over the last 48 hours, basically since your interview, I've been contacted by a leading coach of a leading player who didn't want to give a name, but was happy to tell me that for decades, he said he's witnessed behaviour that has sickened him, both on the ATP and WTA tours. He said he would have called an independent number 100 times to report signals or inappropriate behaviour by coaches that he's seen, trainers, physios, mental coaches, even gurus, he says, if he could have done. And he stressed the importance that phone number needs to be independently looked after to protect the identity of the person who's calling and also to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest in terms of vested interests within the sport, which I guess the truth is the WTA has a vested interest in the sport. No matter how much they want to do the right thing for the right reasons, they're not strictly speaking independent. They're representing players, they're representing tournaments, they're running a business. And so I then wrote to the WTA and asked if there is an independent number or similar currently in operation that players or coaches or anybody concerned on the circuit could use to report behaviour if they are concerned. And this is what I was told. At this point, there is not an independent phone number. as we have internal resources and staffing, including phone numbers and various contact information in place for anybody to report a concern, which is highly encouraged. It could be considered, though, was what I was told, as we continue to enhance our safeguarding efforts and as conversations continue. Is that what's needed, ultimately? One of the main things that's needed, Pam?
Yeah, one of many things that's needed. I think, you know, what you're talking about there is really important whistleblowing policy, which is that the whistleblower feels totally protected and that what they're coming forward to will be protected to the utmost. And you don't really feel that protection if you're reporting it to the tour. So I haven't taken the time to understand in other sports what the independent whistleblowing situation is for sexual abuse, but I think what you bring up is one of many things that needs to happen. And of course, you know, what the WTA has on their plate in the last few months, I didn't expect to have all the answers by the time you interviewed Steve the other day. I thought it was great he finally came on your podcast, that he discussed the wide range of topics. And as usual, he did it in as open and transparent style as he can, given the fact it is a public forum and there are some things as a CEO that he must keep confidential until ready to come forward publicly.
On this topic of there being a formal, anonymous way to report abuse that you see, I've been looking at the National Women's Soccer League in the US, and that was introduced in 2020, I believe, a formal way to report abuse that was going on. And following that introduction in 2020, there have been a slew, really, of dismissals of coaches. Because that has led to investigations, players have come forward, and that has really helped. So I definitely think that would be an important element here. You know, obviously, I think as well what Pam is saying is it starts with the education, but then in terms of, you know, once we actually get onto the tour, that is something which the tour can implement as well.
That's really fascinating, by the way. All of this is. There was one sort of ideological aspect of it all, Pam, that I just wanted to get your thoughts on. I'm going to diverge for a moment. Bear with me here. In one of the lockdowns, I think it was the one just over a year ago. Lockdown one, I deep dived on OJ Simpson
and Jigsaws.
And Jigsaws. OJ Simpson and Jigsaws. Every bit of content about OJ Simpson, YouTube offered it to me and I gladly accepted. Lockdown 2 in the UK, I deep dived on Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton and that whole episode. And one thing that struck me most about your story, Pam, was your change in perspective on it with the benefit of hindsight and therapy. And you're still changing perspective on it now, and the experience of Monica Lewinsky in that scandal in the 90s is such a fascinating and important case study in that. You know, as recently as 2014, Monica Lewinsky, you know, who was willing to go to jail in defense of this man that she was infatuated by, still wouldn't recognize it as abuse. It took the Me Too scandal for her understanding of consent to evolve to the extent that she now does see that as that relationship as abusive. She said, "I now see how problematic it was that the two of us even got to a place where there was a question of consent. Instead, the road that led there was littered with inappropriate abuse of authority, station, and privilege." And there are one of the deep dives I did on this was with a fantastic Slate podcast on the subject, and they talked about the two schools of feminist thought on the issue, and there was one at the time and that still exists now called the Libertines, who made the argument that Monica Lewinsky was a consenting adult, yes, a young one, but an adult who entered into and indeed pursued a relationship with another consenting adult. Was that a bad decision? Yes, but adults, they're allowed to make bad decisions. And the Libertines objected to Lewinsky being seen as a victim. They said that seeing her as a victim is infantilizing and suggesting that an adult woman doesn't have the agency to make decisions about her sex and romantic life is anti-feminist in a way. But then, of course, there's the other school of thought, which gets into power dynamics and the significance of those and the inequality of age, of power, of rationality. And that is something that it feels to me like, as a world, we're only just beginning to understand. And it feels like you've been on that journey about your own experience, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm evolving every day during this week. I didn't do a lot between when we recorded the pod in Indian Wells and when the release happened on Wednesday. I really chose to just keep it to within our team. It felt the safest way for me. So, you know, really, maybe in hindsight, I'll say, well, maybe I should have done a little more preparation work. So when I had, you know, when I was going to do the tennis.com and the ESPN.com, and I've done some interviews with the BBC, that I would be a little bit more of that expert that Nancy Hogshead would like me to become. But you know what? In cases like this, you just sort of take your comfort level and you evolve in your own time frame. I was also dealing with a lot in my own family, as far as I had some kids that were sick. I had some dealings with my son's type 1 diabetes. It's like life as a single mom goes on, whether or not I disclose something of abusive nature that occurred over 40 years ago. So there was a lot going on this week, but yes, the layers of the onion continue to be peeled, and I can't tell you where I will end up with this, but I have certainly reclassified my identification as two kinds of abuse.
And I think the issue of power dynamics is really cuts to the heart of it when we talk about player-coach relationships as well, doesn't it? I mean, just thinking about, you know, sports generally, athletes, you know, they're told maybe not to question their coach so much, and their coach is afforded a level of protection because they're the ones who are maybe seen as the route to success or the reason for success. You've also got the fact that in sport, it's accepted that a coach will touch a player. They will maybe physically move them or show them the movements by touching their body. And Pam, you referenced student teachers before. That would never be accepted in a classroom, or eyebrows would raise, certainly, whereas they don't so much in sport. And I think sort of changing that mindset might be something to come from this. And also just realizing that, yeah, you can break these boundaries, chip away at them, and eventually they're crossed and you don't even realize that they've been crossed. And I think in tennis also, it's an interesting relationship with the fact that, you know, the coach is hired by the player, and, you know, it's potentially therefore in the best interests of the coach to get as close as possible to the player, you know, for potentially financial reasons or job security reasons. There's all sorts of dynamics here at play which lead to that being a potentially difficult relationship, which could lead to problems.
You know, one of the biggest problems I see right now is the WTA Tour. They don't even know from tournament to tournament who's coming into their world as part of their group of players who are entered in the tournament, their support team. They don't even have them registered. They don't know. So there has to be so much to make this workplace safe, where anyone entering into the workplace, they need to know who they are. They need to know some sort of background check. They need to know that they've received the education prior to entering the workplace. It's just a lot, and it's not going to happen, you know, between now and the summer of 2022. But I really think it can be in place. They say this major change that was going to be in place by January of 2023. Well, I think they now know it's got a lot more layers, and there's going to have to be a lot more to make the workplace safe. But and the coaches have got to come, coaches and the team members above everybody else have to be willing to come to the table and be ready to be retrained and ready to accept that if they cross over that line, that they are violating the laws of tennis and they are becoming abusers. And to me, it becomes more and more simple, and they have to just draw those clear lines in the sand that cannot be crossed going forward.
I find that really, really interesting and on a number of levels. But one thing that I keep wrestling with is whether it is possible to have a relationship with somebody on the tour that is your coach and it to be healthy and successful. Because a lot of people meet their life partners in the workplace. They don't necessarily stop being colleagues within that workplace. And I know it's different and I don't have the answer to it, but I'm just trying to work it out because you're making that categoric. You're effectively mm-hmm. saying if your coach becomes your partner or it does cross that line, then that person has to stop being your coach.
Correct. That's actually what I am saying. And that's in workplaces, like I've worked for ESPN Disney now for over 30 years. In the case, they didn't have very strong workplace protocols when I started back in the early 90s, but they have developed extremely safe. So you cannot enter into a relationship with somebody you report to. Until you fully disclose it and the company has time to figure out what different divisions the two people will now work. Like, in other words, they're not going to, once it's disclosed, they're not going to allow that reporting relationship continue while there's a personal sexual relationship. And that is a healthier workplace when that happens. So yes, I get it. I know maybe I'm dreaming to think there can be this firm of a workplace boundary setting to take place, but I continue to dream big on this. I think it can happen. And I think for these young athletes needs to happen.
Well, it exists that categorically in teacher-student scenarios, doesn't it? Categorically, no matter what the situation, no matter what the defense is, no matter how much both parties say they are in their right mind and consenting, it is considered wrong. End of story. So that framework exists, and that is I don't hear much opposition to that in the population. You know, it's pretty much accepted as the way things should be. So hopefully it's possible. Just one final one for you, Pam. Just sort of going back a little bit to the shift in perspective over time. How would you have responded if those pathways, if something like Matt described existing in women's soccer in the States, if something like that had existed in the WTA and you had been reported and your relationship had been investigated at the time, how would you have reacted? How would you have felt?
Wow. Going back to, the early 80s, how would I have felt? I guess it would have felt really quite foreign to me. I would have been, on the one hand, scared, but I think on the other hand, eventually I would have felt great relief that somebody was coming to help me and try and help me kind of reset things that eventually 5.5 years later I could reset. But I think it would have been a great thing.
Goodness me, I hope that I hope that these things happen. I know they're not going to happen overnight, but I really hope they happen. And it, you know, you sound even more clear and confident about it all, Pam, than you did a few weeks ago when we spoke in Indian Wells. It's incredible what you're doing, and I think it's going to change things. I really do. And hopefully this is just the start of a very important conversation which will keep evolving in tennis. We have other meaty tennis topics, well, world topics, frankly, to get into that tennis is embroiling itself in, as tennis is wont to do. Because as Pam mentioned, alluded to in our sort of plans for releasing your story this week, Pam, it was rather torpedoed by Wimbledon making a rather big announcement, one that was sort of has been whispered about for the last few weeks. I know Simon Briggs, The Telegraph, wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago. hinting that, you know, it was some banning Russian and Belarusian players was something that Wimbledon were prepared to do. But I think the move of them actually doing it, followed up by the LTA, the Lawn Tennis Association, the governing body of British tennis, saying that they would reflect that ban in all British tour level tennis events as well. I think the strength of that and the timing of it somewhat took tennis by surprise. Who would like to go first with their reaction to this incredibly nuanced and knotty issue of Russian and Belarusian players being banned from Wimbledon and from British events this summer? Oh, a clamour of people wanting to talk.
I'll chime in first if you want. When the day, a couple hours later after my story was released by the podcast and the Telegraph, a couple hours later it became official, right? So the news kind of shifted, but I was still wrapped in my coming out with my story. So it took me a few extra days to kind of soak it all up and kind of read a lot. I read a lot. And I know I posted on my Twitter a story from Sally Jenkins, a sports writer. It's about my age, whose dad was legendary sports writer. So she's second generation. And her column in the Washington Post, I thought got it really right once I read the entire article. And that is that, you know, there's a lot of people that don't ask to be in a war. And the ones that you feel for most right now are the families, the children that are on the ground in Ukraine, lives being torn apart, traumas being dealt out every single day that they may never recover from, even if they live through the war. So the fact that innocent people are affected by wars, guess what? That happens. So Sally's article kind of said, kind of put that in perspective, like, and also understanding that the way NATO, the way the powers of the world outside of Russia have decided to deal with it for now is by not doing business as much as possible with Russia and people who have businesses of who are Russian. So when you look at the sport of tennis, at the end of the day, tennis players are in the business of tennis. And so I think Wimbledon kind of looked at it, and being a private club, they can look at it pretty simply than more so than maybe the other three majors who are owned by national federations. I think they looked at it pretty simply that they wanted to have their tournament be a part of not doing business. And hopefully by all of these sanctions, eventually it will get through without the escalation of a war that we haven't seen since World War II is over. So I think just like Wimbledon makes smart decisions other years, like who would have thought a pandemic insurance existed? They make smart decisions. They don't make it in a vacuum. And I think their decision is correct. And I think that Sally Jenkins spelled it out beautifully. And that's my, I have adopted that position. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, you know, Pam, I've been wrestling with it all week. And actually before this, because it was coming, you know, we'd been making jokes on the podcast about, you know, having to figure out how we feel about this incredibly knotty issue for a while and sort of knowing we'd have to figure that out and declare it at some point soon on the podcast. And when I read that Sally Jenkins piece that you tweeted and that actually almost simultaneously my dad sent me sent me a link to as well, it was a light bulb moment of kind of summing up a lot of things that I'd felt in the pit of my stomach about it. In short, you know, it being unfair doesn't make it wrong. You know, all the sanctions being imposed on Russia are impacting its citizens, many of whom are blameless for the conflict other than holding a Russian passport. And you know, the whole situation, and in particular that article, it gave me flashbacks to my philosophy degree and, you know, the big question of are the citizens of a state liable for what it does in their name, especially in a country that in no practical way is a democracy, which is how I think of Russia. And I think the answer is that it has to be. The citizens have to be held responsible in an ideological sense, not on an individual level. I don't hold Andrei Rublev in any way responsible for what Vladimir Putin is doing, but as a collective, ideologically, I think we have to. And an academic called Anna Stiltz is quoted in that Sally Jenkins piece, an essay that she wrote titled Collective Responsibility in the State. And she says that if we end up unable to distribute state responsibility to the members of that state, then we're in danger of establishing perverse incentives. States become responsibility laundering machines in which citizens can just dissociate themselves from any sense of liability for the atrocities. Maintaining some sense of personal liability for states is what gives people the incentive to exercise their political will and limit the harm of a state through dissent and civil disobedience. And revolt, this is me talking now, revolt or uprising from the Russian people, from what I can gather from people that know about these things, is one of the most plausible ways that this conflict comes to an end. And for me, that end justifies these means. This is a high-stakes situation, and the means, as awfully unfair as it is to the Russian and Belarusian players, I really feel sympathy for them. I think they are collateral damage in a situation of immense collateral damage. And just one last thing before David and Matt, I'm desperate to get your views. Imagine that there was no ban, and imagine Daniil Medvedev wins Wimbledon this year. Okay, it's not likely. I doubt anybody would have been picking him, but it's totally possible. And regardless of how he feels personally about the war, the images of him holding that trophy would be wielded by Putin as a weapon of war propaganda. They would be. He's got a history of that. He uses athletic achievements for propaganda purposes. And frankly, that needs to not be possible. And again, the means of making that not possible justify the ends for me.
I've gone back and forth over the last week over this issue, and I think I probably speak for all of us to say that there is not an immediate take on this. As Pam said, it took her a while to arrive where she has arrived to. I think the same is true of Catherine. We're not on one side where there isn't another side to consider here. This is the most difficult view I've probably ever had to come to on the tennis podcast in 10 years as to what do I feel about this? What do I feel is the right thing to do? Because I genuinely see both sides to the point where I could land on one side or the other. In as much as, let's look at some of the things that have been said here by Steve Simon a couple of days ago on our podcast interview, and in the statement of the WTA and the ATP, that they feel that this is discrimination against these individual athletes and that there is no room for discrimination in these sports. Strictly speaking, it is discrimination. You are stopping these athletes from playing the biggest tournaments in the world, in the views of many, simply because of where they were born and the nationality they represent, and it's not their fault. They've done nothing individually to deserve that. And it's quite interesting with the polls that I've seen from Chris Clary and Ben Rothenberg and myself, all people who work in tennis have said, is this the right decision or is it not? And around about 70% of people do not agree with this decision, but I think that those are tennis people. I don't know about nations generally. The reason I ran one after they ran one is because I think the view was, well, British people think that this is the right decision. So I thought, as a British person, maybe I've got more people from Britain following me. Let's see what they say. I think it's more tennis people that are thinking that this is appalling to ban these individual athletes who've done nothing wrong. Billie Jean King put out a statement saying she doesn't agree with it. Now, Billie Jean King, I would imagine, is listening to this show right now and is somebody we respect and listen to probably more than anybody in the tennis world. And yet here I am about to say that I think that is not how I feel about it. Ultimately, I do agree with the the sentiment. I don't feel comfortable with this in any way. I feel terrible for these players that are being banned from playing Wimbledon. And I'm really worried about the fact that we don't know how many years this is going to last for. They may never play Wimbledon again, for all we know. And that feels terrible. But war is terrible to a degree many, 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 many times more than that. And this is the highest stakes war of my lifetime. And it has the potential to be the highest stakes war ever. And that has to take precedent over everything, ultimately, I think. I think there's an interesting element to this that the LTA have gone with them on this. I think it's very interesting rules-wise, because whereas Wimbledon is a private club and looking after one of the four biggest tournaments in the world, and you get the feeling a bit like the French Open moving their dates, they can just frankly do what they like, get away with it, be Wimbledon, and everybody will still want to enter, and everybody will still want to watch. Well, the LTA have done it with Queens and Eastbourne and Birmingham. And those are tour events. They have sanctions that they've purchased on the tour in order to have ranking points and to be on the calendar. I wonder what's going to happen there, because I think that the tours sound absolutely steadfast in their view that this isn't on. And they could well have some pretty significant measures to mete out to them. But ultimately, and it pains me to say it, I think Wimbledon are doing the right thing.
It, more than not on, David, my understanding is that they're actually legally in breach by making that decision, you know, right or wrong. The impression I get is that the tours, if they wanted to really go for this issue, they would be on pretty strong ground legally. Against the LTA in their position, I think the Wimbledon situation is somewhat different. They have more leeway, as you said, Pam, an independent club, and also not a tour. You know, it's a Grand Slam event rather than a tour event. So how far they want to take it, you know, we could enter a standoff here, hashtag Tennis United. How far the various parties want to take this is going to be very interesting.
Just before I give my view generally, I just wanted to pick up on that point. And it is, I think, a problem here, tennis not acting in unison on this, because I do think Wimbledon's unilateral decision on this, as right as it might be, has put the sport in a difficult place. Because if the ATP and the WTA are seen to sanction Wimbledon in some way by taking away ranking points, that is maybe symbolically more than anything, but symbolically it is moving against something which Wimbledon says is anti-Russia, pro-Ukraine, and that makes the move of the tours difficult. You know, that is them therefore taking an opposite stance to that, which I think is putting them in quite a difficult place. It also means that absolutely Wimbledon is the most prestigious tennis tournament in the world. And I completely agree that they are really trying to avoid the worst case scenario here of having a Russian or a Belarusian player win that title. But if Russians and Belarusians are still playing on the tour, they could win the French Open. They could win the US Open. They could, I mean, today, spoiler for the second bit of this podcast, you know, a Russian beat the world number one in a final. If that wanted to be used by the Russian regime, you know, holding Russia up in lights, using it for political gain, it still could be. And tennis still would be being kind of manipulated in that way. And I don't think that's good for the sport to be in this position where there is so much disagreement. In terms of my take generally, I genuinely, and I'm really not just saying this, I genuinely haven't come down on either side. I have read saying that Wimbledon is right, saying that Wimbledon is wrong, and I don't have a strong opinion either way. And I don't mean that I don't care. It's quite the opposite. You know, I've gone back and forth on it. I'm very, very torn on it. And I absolutely agree with all the points you've made in favour of why this is maybe not fair, but ultimately the right decision. I think you've all said it very, very well. I just wanted to present the other side, just so that we have, I think, on this podcast, I think, because as you said, a lot of people do disagree with this, and some of the strongest arguments against it for me, number one, is that it's maybe not an extension of the sanctions that are already in place, because sanctioning a state, which then has consequences for its individual citizens, is not the same as directly sanctioning the athletes themselves. It's more targeted rather than having them as collateral damage. And I think that was quite a persuasive argument for me. Also, the fact that this could be used by Putin to present the idea of anti-Russian sentiment in the West. He might use it as kind of propaganda in the Russian state media to, you know, and create more of an us versus them than there already is. I think that's quite a persuasive argument. There's the slippery slope argument about what sort of precedent this sets and why has this not been applied to other nations in the past necessarily. You know, Wimbledon describes this as unprecedented military aggression. And look, it is horrific what is happening in Ukraine. But it's also absolutely horrific what China's doing in Xinjiang at the moment. And I really don't want to do sort of whataboutery here, but I think, you know, it's important to ask why we haven't applied this in the past. You know, a lot of people have brought up the US and the UK's involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. And I want to get into all that, but I think these are important questions as well. And then this big, big question of whether citizens should be held responsible for the actions of the state. Catherine, I know you laid out the case there, and I've read that piece that was cited in the Washington Post article. I've read a counterpiece by Avia Pasternak, who, for her, it depends on the type of regime. And in an authoritarian regime, she thinks you can't hold individual citizens responsible due to the extraordinary levels of brainwashing that goes on, due to the political repression. She says that when an international community imposes sanctions and compensation schemes on such states, it is unjustly saddling their ordinary citizens. And it's precisely in those cases that more careful and nuanced models of responsibility attribution should be found, ones that pierce the veil of the state and go after those who do share the blame for the state's wrongdoing. And I think there'd be a lot of people that would agree with that as well. So, as I'm saying, I honestly haven't come down one way or the other. It's an incredibly difficult issue. I think a lot of the Ukrainian players were suggesting that an alternative might be to ask Russian and Belarusian players to sign a form or to publicly state their position. I personally didn't think that would work. You'd be introducing something in tennis that could put individual athletes in danger. You know, Russia has signed laws that for anyone who speaks out against Putin, they could be punished. Or if not the individuals, then certainly their families as well. So I actually think a ban is probably, I don't want to use the word better, but I can't think of another word at the moment, but is better than that. But of course, everything is deeply unsatisfactory either way. It's a very, very horrible situation, and I honestly haven't come down on either side. But I just wanted to present the alternative viewpoint there.
That's always felt like a red herring to me, the suggestion that a way to circumvent the ban might be for individual players to sign some sort of anti-war, anti-Putin declaration, because that wouldn't be reported in Russia. Or if it were, it would be reported in a non-factual, twisted way. So I'm not sure. I'm glad that hasn't been a feature of the decision that's been made, because that's always felt like it's missed the point somewhat to me. Of course, Matt, I found all of those arguments incredibly persuasive, and I'm now sort of shaking in my already shaky conviction in how I feel. But I think I still do remain 51-49, but my goodness me, what a what a tricky one. And also, having said that, having declared how I feel and standing by that, I also think it's probably the right thing for the WTA and the ATP to be contesting it, because that is their role.
Member organisations.
To defend their players. So, and the point you make, Matt, about that putting them optically and in reality in a very difficult position is a really interesting one, because I think they should have the right to defend their players and fight for them regardless of the rights and wrongs of the ban here. And yeah, optically that could be, oh my goodness me, it could get messy, couldn't it? I'll say it again, folks, hashtag Tennis United.
What about Andre Rublev's proposal? Let us play, but we'll give all the prize money to Ukrainian victims of this war.
I think it's lovely, but I don't think it solves any of the actual issues at hand. This is largely ideological. Largely ideological.
Trying to think about how tennis players could lead something of significance in their home country, because let's face it, there's some really influential athletes here. First off, you'd have to make sure all your family members were out and safe, right? I mean, this is so complex, and we don't even know whether or not any of these influential athletes are in that position where they have who they need out. But you just wonder whether or not, when you think about the history of people getting a groundswell of support and being able to get the groundswell happening, is it impossible? Could, I don't know. I look at some of the great people in tennis of, you know, whether it's Arthur Ashe, Billie Jean King, Althea Gibson. Look at some of the great things they were able to do. This would probably be the most significant, but I wish a couple of them could think together, like, how can we get the groundswell? How can we start to get society in Russia to just overthrow? It sounds so simple, but I'm just like, so Rublev, I can't accept that that's acceptable at this point, given what's going on, but take your energy, and think about how you can take your influence and maybe start a groundswell.
Who would want to be a tennis administrator? Yeah, lots of shaking heads, folks.
Can we just mention the irony that the ATP and WTA launched their new Tennis United live scores app on the day that this was announced? Yeah.
And if we knew it was coming... And we did. Okay, we didn't, you know, have loads of notice, but we knew, what, a couple of days before that Wimbledon were planning to do this announcement. They must have known it was coming. They just thought, guys, we cannot possibly delay this app launch another day. It has to be now. Let's do it. I'm very pleased that app exists, by the way. But it's a moment of levity in a sea of... what's the word? There are probably many words, but all of them a bit too depressing. We're going to talk about tennis now for a bit. Pam wants to exit the fray because she wants to be able to listen to the second portion of the podcast as a as a fan and a listener, which is lovely, Pam.
And as I say goodbye, I just want to thank you three, as well as the fifth member of the team of sort of Pam's podcast and the story team, Simon, who's not here. Just want to thank you guys for your support and helping me tell my story. Thank you.
Oh, Pam, I'm going to speak for everyone here and say we owe you the thanks. Honestly, it's incredible what you've done, and we are honoured that you've chosen here is the place to do it. So thank you very much. And thank you for bringing your views on Russia as well, because that's not an easy thing to put your hand up to talk about either. So thank you, and we'll speak to you soon. And please keep the WhatsApp group alive.
All right, will do. Will do. Bye-bye.
Pam, we'll see
thank
you soon.
Pam.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
So, folks, now we're going to have the novelty experience of talking about tennis. Now, between the three of us, we think we might just have been able to watch enough tennis from the week to be able to tell you what happened and to give our takes on it. But they don't half blooming make it hard for us, David.
Oh, well, I was at a point today, because of the rain delay in Barcelona and everything starting so early there, there were four massive matches in four different locations, three finals, one semi-final, literally all going on at the same time. And like Billie Jean, I was fuming about the, because I only had the one. I mean, people say, oh, we'll watch on multiple screens. Well, at that particular point, my son was watching highlights of Match of the Day. My wife was watching something else. So I'd got the one iPad and I could only watch one of them at any one given time. I was actually waiting for the sit down during the Alcaraz match to go and watch some of the Swiatek against Sabalenka match whilst I was having to miss the Istanbul final completely. So it's all pretty disappointing in that way. But the actual tennis that was played and the stories that came out of it all were really interesting. So there is plenty to get into.
Yeah, I'm going to take a leap here and say that in the circumstances, none of us watched the Istanbul final. Matt, speak now if you managed to watch that. But I don't think any of us did. So I'm just going to tell you that it was won by Anna Potapova. She beat Veronika Kudermetova in two straight sets in that all Russian final, two blank flags next to those players' names. Big win, actually, for Potapova, who was, she was a really good junior, wasn't she? I think a junior number one, or certainly a junior Wimbledon champion. And, you know, she's been slowly creeping up, but she's not had any big moments where she's brought herself to our attention on the senior stage. So that's pretty big for her. We don't need to go into the whole Russian thing. I think we've, you know, covered that in detail. But Potapova, one of two Russian winners today, because we also had Andrei Rublev beating world number one Novak Djokovic in three sets in the Belgrade final. A lot of this match was thrilling. Such a great contest. The second set, won by Djokovic on a tiebreak, was brilliant. And it's, I know after what we saw in the match between Djokovic and Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, it should be believable that Djokovic faded like he did and lost the third set 6-love. And yet it still didn't seem plausible to me that after winning that second set tiebreak, that what ensued would ensue. It was, I know he's reached a final and it's a big step forward in his comeback. No doubt he fought through some great matches this week, Djokovic, but I still find it alarming the steepness of the drop-off In these deciding sets. And he won some three setters this week. This isn't just about, you know, he just doesn't have the energy to go three sets. But it's really, really jarring to see that happen to Novak Djokovic, as brilliant as Rublev was today.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, he has made progress, because in Monte Carlo, the physical drop-off happened after one match. And here he had three other matches in the tank where he'd come back from a set down in all of them. But then it was exactly the same. And what it means, I think, is that there's a lot of progress to make. Let's be honest, let's cut to the chase here. For Roland Garros, that is his big goal over the next few weeks on the clay. And he's got to get to the stage where he can play 7 5-set matches in 14 or 15 days. That's a big progression still that needs to happen for Djokovic. And he's talked about having a virus, hasn't he, in the last couple of weeks, which I think has maybe set him back a little bit more. But he's concerned about it. He said again, look, I know I've had a virus, but I need to speak to my team, because this isn't normal what has happened to me. It's making him uncomfortable. And when Djokovic is uncomfortable, he displays that, and it really sort of affects his kind of personality on the court, and it means that not only is he physically compromised, but sort of mentally a little bit as well. So it's a difficult time for Djokovic, even though he made some progress. And I thought the tennis he played against Kecmanovic down the stretch, and against Karen Khachanov in his penultimate match, I thought the tennis was kind of really there. It was really good from him. He found a higher level sooner than I would have expected. But the physical issue is kind of the main thing and the main worry, I think, for Djokovic.
Yeah, I think ultimately the fact that he had those matches against Kecmanovic and Khachanov, and both involved coming back from a set down to win, and they're often these matches were back-to-back days, and then the same thing happened in this final, set down, wins an absolute grueling epic of a second set, all the emotion that goes with playing in Belgrade. Ultimately, I think my conclusion is maybe it's not that surprising, given where he is in his season, given what's happened to date and how little tennis he's had, how unmatch ready his body probably is, and indeed his psyche probably is. It's probably my ultimate conclusion is it's not that surprising. And yet, I share your view, Catherine. It's still jarring. And there's still a bit of a question mark in my mind as to whether this is more than just the inevitable building blocks of an athlete trying to peak in a few weeks' time when he's not had much tennis. Is that virus more of a problem than we thought? Is maybe it's some remnants of his COVID causing problem? We know he's had the infection earlier on this year. Who knows? You know, we've seen enough people who've struggled with it. Or is he getting old? Is he not as good as he used to be? All these question marks are still in my mind, because he's just lost a 6-love set. I watched him win that second set, went to see my parents, and expected to be back 20 minutes later at 2-2 in the third, and it was over. So that's not what I expect with Novak Djokovic playing a big final in Belgrade. But ultimately, I think that this is probably quite a natural conclusion of everything he's had so far this year.
There's also the issue of the fact he's starting matches badly. You know, he's lost the opening set of every match he's played since he came back on the clay, going back to the Davidovich-Fokina one, and then every match this week in Belgrade. And does feel like the aura of invincibility has been chipped away at a little bit. I think players are stepping onto court with a little bit more belief from the start that they can trouble Djokovic. And maybe that's a stretch, because there were a lot of scenarios last year where he lost the opening set in slams, I think maybe 10 times, and he went on to win every single match. It wasn't an issue for him, and of course he's won several matches this week as well, having lost the first set. But I don't know, there's just something about maybe having seen what's happened to Djokovic in the last few months that maybe a little bit of that aura has gone, and players are stepping on with more belief and causing him problems straight away. And that's, look, it may end here, but it's certainly something that I'm interested in sort of checking out the pattern of over the next few weeks to see whether it you know, keeps happening, because there is only so many times you can keep coming back from one set down. And had he not lost the opening set in all of those matches, he might have had more in the tank for Rublev today and won the match. So there is a knock-on effect as well.
I think that was Andrei Rublev's first ever win over a world number one. I thought he was very impressive to deal. I mean, the same goes for Arina Sabalenka, who we'll talk about in due course from the Stuttgart final, to deal with, you know, what they've been dealing with this week following Wimbledon's announcement. And Andrei Rublev put out, you know, extremely thoughtful, lengthy, heartfelt statement about it, didn't he? We touched upon that with Pam. Incredibly impressive from him to deal with that and beat Djokovic to win the title. Is he, you can see where I'm going with this, folks, in the Roland Garros mix?
No.
Given the vacuum at the top of the game, you know, the relative vacuum, I'm absolutely not, don't come for me, I'm not writing off Djokovic at Roland Garros, but relatively speaking to how men's tennis has looked for the last couple of decades, there is this strange vacuum at the moment at the top of the game. Medvedev's out at the moment. Even if he were in, he's not in the French Open mix, really, is he, realistically? He certainly wouldn't put himself in the mix. So is Rublev in there? Or is it, David, a mix of one?
No, it's not a mix of one. even though I think that Mr. Alcaraz is going to win the French Open. I've been saying it for months. But I feel like Rublev should be in the mix, but he's not in mine. I don't think he's going to win it. I'd be massively surprised if he won it, because I still think he has this top level, and then he puts his foot to the floor and tries to press it down even more because he needs a bit more, and there's nowhere else to go. And I mean, I think today was quite a triumph in as much as, I mean, he makes me really uncomfortable watching him. He won the first set 6-2 today. And then he
David
lost.
David has a real emotional journey with Rublev matches that I mean, I know what you mean, but it doesn't get to me the way it does.
Oh, it exhausts me. It exhausts me. It makes me really uncomfortable watching him. And my daughter as well. She was watching. He'd won the first set 6-2 against Novak Djokovic. He loses 2 points, and he looks like he wants to just go nuts at anybody. About, he can't handle it. He cannot handle the fact that he's just lost 2 points. And then the racket goes, and then he's looking over at his coach as though the coach has just committed some mortal offence over the course of those 2 points. And the whole experience, he looks like he's having the worst time, and as though he needs to be just sent somewhere quiet to just sit on his own until he's calmed down. And I watch that and I think, oh, this is deeply unsettling to me, the state he gets himself into. It's a temper tantrum, and I don't like it. I don't enjoy watching those moments. But the reason I view it as a triumph is because he still managed to play. He didn't like go off the rails when he lost his temper. He got himself back and he beats Novak Djokovic. But I still don't see him in the mix. I don't. No chance.
No, nor do I. I'm just being annoying by asking the question.
I'm just going to lay it out once and for all. It's a mix of four. It's Nadal, it's Djokovic, it's Alcaraz, and it's Tsitsipas.
Yeah, I agree with that, David.
Yeah.
Who's the favourite of those?
Nadal.
David's having a hover. He's thinking about it, Matt. He's thinking about it.
Nadal should be the favourite. I mean, of course, he is the favourite.
Nadal is the favourite.
In any logical world, he is the favourite, but he also hasn't played in about 6 weeks. And I'm picking Alcaraz to win the title. That's
the
end of the
story. Is he the favourite, though?
Did you see the Australian Open, David?
Yeah, and I'm picking Alcaraz to win the French Open.
Yeah, you can pick that, but Nadal is the favourite.
I'm not saying he's the favourite on the bookmakers or anything like that. I'm not saying that, but I'm not wavering in any way.
No, that's fair. I respect
more
that.
More strongly about it.
Because of what happened today, slash this
because
whole week.
Because of what's happened the last month.
Okay, well, let's deal with today, slash the past week. Carlos Alcaraz has won his third title of the year. He's just, he's just sweeping all before him, isn't he? Today, he beat Alex de Minaur, 6-4 in the third, saving two match points, 3 hours, 37 minutes. And then he comes back later on in the day and just brushes aside Pablo Carreño Busta, 6-3, 6-2. Carreño Busta had also played his semi-final earlier on today, but had a far easier ride of it, 3-4 in an hour and 35 over Schwartzman. I mean, I think what we've learnt there is that youth is a wonderful thing.
It was hilarious. Well, I mean, De Minaur played really well. It was very interesting watching somebody who could move with Alcaraz at Alcaraz's speed. Because most
Who's
of
faster?
The time...
Oh, who would win a
really
sprint race?
Know. You know, I could... I think you could make a... You could back either one and not be sure. I don't know. But, I mean, I still expected Alcaraz to win, even though he was two match points down. And actually, the first of the two match points was de Minaur coming in on what looked like a forehand put away down the line, which Alcaraz got a little bit lucky to in that he was running that way already. But he overran the ball and had to step around it and play this improvised sort of faded forehand around de Minaur to very clever improvisation, because it wasn't a ripped forehand, it was just guided in order to put himself in with a chance of winning the point, and he won that point. But yeah, de Minaur is so fast, and he was so dogged out there today. He just wouldn't let go mentally in the whole match, stayed with him. And Alcaraz wasn't playing that well, and there have been points of this week where he hasn't played that well. And yet he's won the tournament. He's won Barcelona, where all these great players and proper clay courts are playing. He beat Tsitsipas. And again, he had some wobbles in that match against Tsitsipas, despite probably putting together four or five games in a row, the likes of which I don't think I've seen anybody other than Nadal. There have been spells where Nadal has played tennis that make you gasp, and that's what Alcaraz did in that match. But I don't know. I just think the thing is, Alcaraz is learning all the time how to be a tennis player. He's so raw. He's so good, and he's so advanced in not only his physicality but also his match understanding. And yet, I feel like we're only scratching the surface.
Yeah, in our Kirio Not This Again chat, which is it's current.
Isn't it Kiri on the plane home
oh,
at
yes,
the moment?
Oh, Kiri on the plane home. Yeah, they're both very appropriate. My brother disclosed that his girlfriend Millie's analogy for Carlos Alcaraz, and I'm telling you, they tune in to every Carlos Alcaraz match, every minute of it. They don't miss it. That it's,
the chat's going
to
get renamed.
Can't believe your eyes stuff. Yeah, he's itching to do it. Anyway, Millie's analogy was that it's like the early stages of a new superhero franchise, you know, and they're telling the origin story and you're seeing the portion of the narrative arc where the superhero is discovering their powers for the first time. That's what it's like with Alcaraz, isn't it? It's, you know, he tries something and then he goes, all right, yeah, I can do that as well. Pop that on the list. he's ridiculous.
Yeah, he is. He is. And I think clay, actually, it's been interesting to see him on the clay, which we've thought of all the time as his best surface. You know, that was the surface he broke through on. That was when we first saw him on the Pro Tour in Rio. You know, David went big that he would win the French Open. It felt like the French Open and clay would be Alcaraz's thing. And yet he's been so good on hard courts over the start of this year. I've started to wonder whether actually maybe he's better on a hard court at this stage in his career. He's got such power, Alcaraz, and it's one of his great strengths, of course, but he wants to use that power all the time. And I think getting that balance right of using it versus staying in rallies and not making errors is a challenge for him on clay. he's passing it because, as you said, he won the title without necessarily playing his best. And there were moments where he got that balance perfectly right. But I did think at times, oh, he's pulling the trigger a little bit early, or he's going for a bit too much there. But as you said, he's learning before our eyes. He's getting better at it. And yeah, he's probably got enough time before the French Open to get it completely sorted out. Yeah, it's amazing watching Alcaraz at the moment.
So Alcaraz is a champion in Barcelona. He'll, I hope, have a week off. He can't be playing this week, can he? Have a week off, head to Madrid, where we're expecting to see Nadal back. So just gonna leave that there and let everyone sit with that. Now, while Alcaraz was winning one of his two matches of the day today, there was a final going on in Stuttgart, and Iga Świątek was, surprise, surprise, folks, winning it, because she doesn't lose anything ever. She beat Arina Sabalenka in two straight sets in the final, 2-2 it was, but it was a far closer match than that. Sabalenka, well, actually, no. Maybe it wasn't a far closer match than that. What I mean to say is Sabalenka did not play badly. I don't know what you do against Świątek at the moment. I really don't. She is so confident that she's... I mean, it is impossible to push her back from the baseline. She's happy. She's happy to half volley from there. And she's just seeing it like... seeing the ball like a football 99% of the time, and she's going for all the shots that you only dream about doing and you usually hold yourself back from going for, because if it doesn't work you'll look silly, but it's always working. I think the only risk for Iga Świątek is that she could be peaking too soon, but I don't know. She keeps... It's a snowball, isn't it? The confidence keeps accumulating. I'm only saying that to be devil's advocate. I mean, it's so hard to see her losing when it matters. I suppose I could see her, you know, running out of steam a bit and suffering a loss at one of these warm up tournaments. But just she just looks so head and shoulders above everybody else at the moment. And I wish we would be getting to talk about the possibility of her playing Ash Barty right now. But anyway.
Yeah, I've saw two matches of hers this week, and on the whole, I agree with you. I saw her play Emma Raducanu, who played very well in a 6-4, 6-4 defeat. And I thought, yeah, I thought Sabalenka had moments today. She tried to play it like a hardcore indoor match. And I actually love the Stuttgart indoor clay event. It's the only indoor clay event we get to see, and I actually think it makes her a really good spectacle without the elements for an event of wind and so forth, and yet you've got clay, and it's a wonderful event, Stuttgart as well. Should say though, semi-final, Świątek almost lost, and it was Ludmila Samsonova, wasn't it, who had her on the rails, and it was 5-5, I think, in that third set, and it was really close. Now, I didn't get to see that match, and it's a match I intend to go back and watch because I'm curious. Now, you know, we've seen now, what is it, 23 match wins in a row for Świątek, and I think she's only lost one, maybe two sets in that whole run. I mean, that's an extraordinary run of sets in a row. I know she'd won 28 sets in a row, I think, at one stage I saw. So I'm curious to see what Samsonova did to cause her issues. And when I watch Świątek play at the moment, she gives me a very similar vibe to what Barty was giving in Australia, that she's got the final answers in all the important rallies. You can do all sorts of extraordinary things, but she'll still come up with an answer because she's that good. She's that good at handling pace. She's that good on the defense. She's got so many angles to throw at you. She does look nigh on unstoppable when she's playing well at the moment. But seen enough tournaments where Thomas Muster was on a goodness knows how many match wins in a row, won 7 tournaments in a row coming up to the French Open, and then lost to Michael Stich in the 1995 French Open quarterfinals. These things happen. And so whilst I think she's a heavy favourite at the moment, I love that there are that many good players in women's tennis, that somebody else is going to peak at some point And then will Svantec be able to go with it? That's going to happen at some point.
Really glad I picked this week to have a week off from going for Badossa in the predictions. Although, to be honest, any of the other weeks I predicted she'd win and she didn't would have also been good weeks to have a week off. I went for Rublev.
Oh,
yay! David's had a rough time with Casper Ruud.
I had Casper Ruud, who had three match points against Public Arena Buster, who, by the way, got to the final today, having beaten Diego Schwartzman. Did very, very well. I'm really pleased for you, Arena Buster. And he went and beat Casper Ruud.
Well, I've said this before, but I cannot get over how seamlessly Świątek has stepped into this number one role and just started doing number one things. I mean, she's even winning. She's even winning the titles that Barty won last year in Miami and in Stuttgart. There's just something perfect about the way Świątek is doing what she's doing at the moment, because it very easily could not have been like this. It very easily could have been a void, and just we didn't know who the number one was, and there was no dominant player. And, you know, even making the transition from hard court to clay court, that's a Barty thing. That's something we spoke about a lot with how good she was on every surface. And Świątek can do that as well. And she didn't have much time because she played Billie Jean King Cup last week. That was still on a hard court indoors. She then comes over to the clay. I think she said something like she surprised herself how quickly she made that transition this week. And I agree with you. I could see her losing before Roland Garros, I suppose. Just this sort of sheer thought of, oh, well, surely she can't keep this up. Surely someone is going to maybe peak against her at one point. But this record in big matches, in most important matches, in finals, that has been built up now over a long, long time. That is how Świątek plays in finals. She plays her best tennis, and at the moment, it's better than anyone's, and it's very difficult to imagine her not winning one of these finals at the moment, because she just produces, and it's scary good.
There's no WTA event this week because WTA Madrid starts on Thursday, and the men ATP start on Saturday. So that's going to be lovely and complicated to try and keep up with what stage of the tournament we're at. Great, thank you, tennis. It also means that there's no WTA event this week, whereas I think there are two on the men's tour.
It also means, can I have a moan? Can I have a moan about
yes,
this?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. It also means, because I remember this from Madrid last year, that the women start and they get 2 or 3 days to themselves and their sort of first, second round matches. Then the men come in, and what it means is that when the women's tournament gets to a really exciting stage, those matches are diluted with men's matches as well on the same order of play. But by the time the men get to their really important stage of the tournament, the women's event's pretty much finished, and the men's most important matches at the end of Madrid just get the order of play to themselves. And it makes it extremely complicated to follow. Why they can't just go in sync, I have absolutely no idea. But Madrid last year was a tough watch from a sort of organization perspective, and it sounds like they're doing exactly the same thing again.
Really excited about spending the next 2 weeks getting angry about that, Matt. Thank you for the refresher. Let's all take a moment though to be glad that it's a tennis tournament and not an esports tournament. Hashtag never forget. 2 years ago,
who won? Murray won.
Did he? 2 years ago.
Was it Murray? No. Was it Kiki Bertens?
The Madrid Open was an esports event. Was it David Goffin?
No, it was Murray.
Andy Murray was definitely in the final.
I think Murray won it.
Right. Well, he could do it again, but in tennis terms, because he's taken a wild card into the Madrid Open, having said that he was going to skip the whole clay court season. He's now decided that he couldn't darn help himself, David. And
will
off to
he play
Madrid
the
he
French
goes.
Open, do we think? It's a funny old warm-up for the grass, isn't it?
He said in his statement, or you know, the briefing from his people, that he wanted some top level opposition. Too long. That in discussion with Ivan, too long to go without, you know, match practice.
I do think that's a fair point, actually. Mm. Yeah, I can see why you would want to play. I don't know. I mean, he knows better than me.
He can carry the confidence and the good memories of winning the Madrid Open 2 years ago, albeit in esports. He can carry that into this year.
On a console.
Mm. Can I just say, I have looked it up, and this is a double that isn't talked about enough. Kiki Bertens won Madrid 2019 and then defended her title on esports in 2020.
Why didn't we mention that when we covered her retirement?
That's unreal.
Did she beat Andy Murray in the final 2020?
No, I think they had separate men's and women's.
They had separate, so who won the men's?
I'm pretty sure it was Murray. I haven't looked that
up. Are we doing Tennis Relived for Madrid Esports 2020?
I'm pretty sure we promised to never speak of it again, but here we are.
I really, really need to know who won now and who he beat in the final.
Yes, Murray won.
Was it Goffin?
It was Goffin, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good memory, Catherine.
Thank you very much. It's burned on my brain.
It makes me laugh that we're chatting esports and all of us forgot to say that Carlos Alcaraz is a top 10 player tomorrow.
Thanks, David, for just trashing my hosting capabilities. That was lovely. I mean, that doesn't feel notable for me because, like, he sort of obviously already is, and it's just, I don't know. I mean, obviously. Also, yeah. I'm annoyed with you for throwing me under the bus. So Murray will be playing Madrid.
Just on that, I mean, I got waylaid talking about esports. I was really excited for Murray to have a proper break and come back for the grass. And look, I absolutely agree, he knows best. I'm sure he's had a long, hard think about it and has come to the conclusion that he needs matches and competitive matches. Or Lendl has, but together. But there was something I really liked about the idea of a break and then coming in fresh for the grass. And look, he might still be fresh. He might not win many matches in Madrid and Rome. But I don't know. I was excited about the clean break and the restart.
Mm. He just couldn't help himself, though, could he? Mm. Anyway, it'll be an added level of intrigue, won't it,
totally.
For this tournament. So looking forward to it. Starts on Thursday/Saturday. In other tennis news from the week, Milos Raonic has got married. If you want to see a weird wedding photo, head to Milos Raonic's social media. It looks like he's never met his wife before. But there is a lovely dog just in the corner of the photo, which salvages the whole thing. Maria Sharapova's having a baby. Lovely. Congratulations, Maria. Any other births, deaths, marriages to report?
I think the aforementioned Kiki Bertens
had a baby. Yes. Yeah. Not as big a triumph as defending her title in Madrid in 2020, but congratulations, Kiki, and belated congratulations for that extraordinary feat. Anything else, folks?
I have a weird bit of any other business. I was perplexed as to why the second court in Barcelona was called the Pista Jan Kodesh.
Yes.
Because, you know, I didn't associate Jan Kodesh with Barcelona particularly. He did win that title. And it turns out what they're doing is every year they're changing the name of the second court to honour a former champion. And, of course, you may think, well, the main court is already named after Rafael Nadal. So I do wonder whether we're going to get to 2048 or whatever it is. And the main court and the second court will be the Pista Rafa Nadal, maybe. Or they'll just have to skip like 12 years and skip straight to Kei Nishikori.
Did Kei Nishikori win it?
He defended his title in Barcelona.
No chance, really.
He did. Mm. He did.
That's a good. Todd Martin won it the 1 year.
Oh, brilliant. So we're going to get the Pista Todd Martin.
Anyone else? David from the
90s. Didn't Milos Raonic win it 1 year? We'll get to the final.
No.
Don't think so.
I mean, no. I'm just going to say no, that didn't happen. sure. Anyway, many congratulations, Milos, on your nuptials. I think that's it, folks, for today's Bumper Tennis Podcast. Thank you for getting this far. If you have, important stuff to cover this week, so we've let ourselves waffle on for a little bit longer than usual. So, yeah, hope you've enjoyed it. We have mascots. And I'm using the plural deliberately because we have Bailey and we have Maddie, owned by Paula and Czech. Ketch?
Czech,
I think.
What
are those two things? Czech, lovely. Paula and Czech. And Bailey is a female Chinese crested powder puff mixed with a Yorkie. And Maddie, or Madison, is a 15-year-old male miniature poodle with Dumbo ears. And he really does have Dumbo ears. And of course, Billie Jean, who you've heard a lot throughout the course of this podcast because she's been annoying, is also half miniature poodle. So we like Maddie very much. And also, I very much like Bailey. A Chinese crested, I didn't know they were powder puffs, but a Chinese crested is one of those dogs that's actually really cute. But when you see them on Crufts, they've always got a weird haircut that makes them a lot less cute. But in the wild, they're delightful. So thank you to lovely Bailey and lovely Maddie for being our mascots this week. We have our mascots. I've got Carter, David's got Darwin, Matt's got Gerald the cat. Both myself and Matt, Carter and Gerald, scored this week. David was let down by Casper Ruud. Sorry, Darwin. Billie Jean, who's not covered herself in glory in this week's recording. She's sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. We have our executive producers, Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner, both of them top blokes. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Karen Maybaum from Lausanne in Switzerland.
Oh, another Swiss one.
Yes, had a few of those.
Yes. Are we confident about the pronunciation of Lausanne?
Yes, I think so. Okay. I think that might be the good French part, French-speaking part.
Karen, did you say?
Karen Maybaum, and I'm not sure about Karen. That.
Thank you very much for your support, Karen, and for being one of our apparently many Swiss listeners.
We also have Stephen Malloy from County Clare in Ireland. And Stephen's regularly
Stephen.
In touch.
Yes.
Stephen, one of my favourite Twitter contributors, who often replies to things we put out with better replies than the original tweet. but I'll forgive him for that because he's very entertaining. And top bloke. Can I
top
use that?
Top bloke, Stephen.
Or only executive producers get called top bloke.
Medium bloke. Thank you very much, Stephen.
And finally, we have Elizabeth Jones from Boston. And Elizabeth is a huge Andy Murray fan. She lived in London during his peak years. So she went to watch him at Queen's, at the ATP Finals, at Wimbledon, even the Davis Cup. And she moved back to the US in 2017, and she's worried that she jinxed Andy Murray by doing so.
Well, maybe she did.
Listen, maybe.
That evidence is strong. Elizabeth, I hope you're looking forward to Madrid.
Big, yeah.
Yep. Thank you very much for your support. I've been to Boston. I liked it very much.
Yes, me too. It was great.
Mm. We should wrap up now because Billie Jean's noises are getting extremely distracting, aren't they?
She's gnawing the microphone wire as we speak, folks.
Yeah, it's becoming a bit of a high wire act.
Can I just say, David, I'm pretty sure you spent a couple of minutes researching whether Milos Raonic won Barcelona. Can you?
Yes, I did.
He didn't, did he?
No, but he got to two consecutive semi-finals in 2012 and 2013, and he beat the aforementioned Andy Murray on clay. Oh, thank you very much.
Wow, what a note to end on, folks. Milos Raonic's illustrious clay court career in Barcelona. That's it, folks. I'm really sorry about what Billie Jean had to say at various points during this recording. Thanks for listening. I'm sure lots of you will be in touch about the various issues we've covered this week. It's important stuff, and we hope we've done the issues justice. And thanks once again to Pam Shriver for telling her story and for opening such a vital conversation. We'll be back next week with another tennis podcast when there'll have been a couple of days of men's Madrid and several more days of women's Madrid, and I'm sure there'll be some sort of rant for you to look forward to. So thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you then.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.